Morning Glory, evening Grace, America, 7 minutes after the hour on this, the 16th day of January 2007. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show, joined now by Dr. Thomas P.M. Barnett, author of the Pentagon's new map for the second of our 8 conversations, one chapter at a time from that book, that very influential book. If you're just tuning in for the first time, Dr. Barnett shook up the Pentagon after 9/11 with his understanding of the Pentagon's new map, and this is a New York Times bestseller that continues to become the source of many, many heated conversations and much conversation here. Dr. Barnett, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me again, Hugh.
Let's begin by recapping Chapter 1, the theme. More rules means less war, and so expanding globalization's rule set leads ultimately to less violence, a result in America's favor. That's how you phrase it in Chapter 2. Do we need to expand on that at all?
Well, just to counter the usual criticism of that argument, which is to say I'm the second coming of Norman Angell, the British philosopher who in 1911 wrote a book about the Grand Illusion, saying that the economic connectivity of that globalization's era was going to prevent war between great powers. He said if they did go to war, they'd ruin each other. His thesis was declared wrong by World War I, by many people's observations, and yet his ultimate prediction proved true. All the empires that went into World War I came out fatally damaged and lost their status as first-tier powers. So I say I'm the second coming of Norman Angell, but I'm Norman Angell with nukes.
With nukes.
And nukes change everything.
Let's pick up there. By the way, do you watch 24, Dr. Barnett?
I wish I had the time.
Oh, they changed Magic Mountain last night. Let's go to page 89. The Pentagon reacted badly, you describe, in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union. Can you expand on that?
Well, they really had gotten so used to letting the Soviets size our forces that we entertained the notion for a while that the Soviets were going to come back. That was the reconstitution pillar of the early 90s. And then we really glommed on to China as basically the replacement in the 95-96 Taiwan Straits crises. That works if China doesn't join globalization so dramatically and become so financially integrated to a degree I don't think the average American understands with the U.S. economy, to the point now where we look ahead to China and our aging demographics and we realize all those savings in Asia are going to be what relieves our boomers of all their financial assets and allows them to retire with wealth. So it's a tough sell the further we get into globalization to make the argument that China's going to be our logical sizing, a force structure sizing element. And instead, we found ourselves engrossed in a series of all sorts of what they like to call inside the Pentagon lesser included. Now, to explain that concept, I have to explain first the notion of the greater inclusive, which is the notion that we plan for the big war. Okay, and we assume if we buy forces and shape our forces for the big war, then they're able to handle all the smaller contingencies that present themselves. So if I build a war for a force, for example, that's able to fight China in a massive force-on-force conflict, we make the assumption that that force can also do counterinsurgency in Iraq and maybe nation building in Iraq or crisis response or post-disaster humanitarian relief. And what we found across the 90s is that that doesn't work. If you buy one force, that big war force, and then operate another, a force that focuses on all the, what they like to call inside the Pentagon military operations other than war, the acronym MOOTWA, M-O-O-T-W, it creates such strain within your personnel system and within your existing force structure in terms of the losses of materiel and the requirements for repair and remanufacturing that after a while you'll break that force if you keep buying for the big war but keep using that force consistently for the everything else, so that what they call the lesser included.
Now, I want to come back to China in a few minutes, but first I want to get the concept across the audience. What you mean by the Red Army as the measuring stick for the Pentagon, how we sized our force. Can you explain a little bit more what that means to laymen?
Well, it was a force-on-force or a symmetrical war notion. We were going to fight a force that looked pretty much like ours. We had Marines, they had Marines. We had a Navy, they had a Navy. We had an Army with lots of tanks, they had an Army with lots of tanks. We had an advanced Air Force, they had an advanced Air Force. And we were going to fight a classic set piece stretched across Europe, focused on the Fulda Gap in Germany. And so we had that long-term standoff that kind of solidified in our minds the notion of a rerun of the Second World War, but this time with nukes. So it became pretty easy to say, how many forces do we need? What kind of forces do we need? Keep an eye on the Soviets, whatever they got. We want a little bit more, or we want a little bit better. And that's how we kept our lead, you know, always giving them just enough pause between that conventional capability and our nuclear weapons to say, you know what? War with the Americans is just too big a risk. That was the essential deterrence that kept Europe safe across the Cold War.
And after they went away, you present a Pentagon almost stunned or concussed and unable to develop a doctrine by which to size its forces. Meanwhile, it's enmeshed in Somalia, Haiti, Yugoslavia, Desert Storm, and that they didn't like all these small forces. But it sounds like a period. Were they self-aware of a decade of confusion, Thomas Barnett?
Sure they were. I mean, I describe in the second chapter an effort to create the first naval white paper in about 50 years to kind of figure out what the heck do we have a Navy for. And
explain a white paper, would you? Tell people what a white paper is.
A white paper in this instance, I mean, white papers get created all the time, but this was a seminal white paper. It was later dubbed From the Sea, and it was an attempt to redefine, now that the Soviets were gone away and the Red Navy was disappearing before our eyes, why we had a Navy and what we were going to do with it. And the key distinction of that document, which I helped draft with a bunch of other officers, was instead of saying we use our Navy primarily to control the seas, we made the following leap. We said from now on, we use our control of the seas to influence events ashore. And that was a huge shift for the Navy, understanding that basically for the first time in human history, we had the world's only blue water Navy, a position we retain now. And it gives us an amazing capacity to project power around the planet. What we've been struggling with ever since is, what do we do with that amazing power?
Now, in that discussion, which I found fascinating, by the way, about the From the Sea white paper, the bullet point that got changed originally read, fundamental purpose of naval forces is to achieve command of the seas. It got changed to read, fundamental purpose of naval forces is to use command of the sea.
Right.
And from that change flowed all the... Explain to people how that one word mattered so much in a Pentagon of the 90s.
Well, again, it was the Navy admitting that there wasn't anybody out there who was going to stop us from controlling the seas. And if you think about the course of human history and the empires of the past, to be a great power was to have a great Navy. If you had a great Navy, you could roam the world, you could wage war distant from your shores, you could control commerce. The essential connectivity until very recently in the global economy was control of the high seas, which is why our fundamental rule set with regard to our naval forces has been freedom of the seas. Maintain that connectivity with the outside world. Well, what we were admitting by making that one word change almost was just to say, from now on, we basically own the oceans. And the question is, what do we do with that power?
And explain to people why that fundamentally threatened the submarine service.
Well, the submarine service was the most symmetrically focused on the Soviet Union. Submarines aren't great really for anything other than destroying the other countries' ships' lines of communication, destroying their movement of materiel and whatnot, like U-boats did to our ships during the Second World War and the Atlantic crossing, and they fight each other. And what happened was, when the Soviets went away, their submarine community disappeared. And if you don't have submarines to threaten our force, you don't have submarines to go after. And if you don't have submarines to go after, you don't have a reason for submarines.
Now, clearly, and we got a minute to the break, this throws procurement into the hat. I mean, everything goes up for grabs once you begin to realize a fundamental miscalculation, or not miscalculation, but change in what you need.
Well, but what we did, basically, with the Powell Doctrine, we basically said, you know what, unless I'm going to go in and go in very rapidly with very decisive force, with very limited objectives, which across the 1990s typically amounted to, we're here for the bad guys, then we're leaving. I mean, that was the first iteration of that was Just Cause with Manuel Noriega in Panama. The basic deal that the Powell Doctrine offered in terms of force structure was, until we can get a clear sense of the future, we're going to cut everything roughly equally. So we just miniaturize slowly our force over time. And that made it hard because the thing we were using more and more were these forces and these specialized units, a lot of them in the reserve component, the National Guard and the reserves, for these military operations other than war. So we were overusing special operations, overusing military police and whatnot, and that came a cropper with Iraq.
We'll be right back. Dr. Thomas Barnett, author of The Pentagon's New Map, is my guest. It's The Hugh Hewitt Show. 21 minutes after the hour, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for listening. My guest, Thomas Barnett, author of The Pentagon's New Map. Dr. Barnett, when we went to break, we're talking about one of the many efforts the Pentagon went through in the 90s to cope with the fact that the Soviet Union was gone. It was the Navy's reassessment. You divided the people that were part of that into transitioners, big sticks, and cold warriors. Can you explain the difference between those three?
Well, it was all based on this really iconic view graph, or PowerPoint slide, as we call them now, that was presented by the Chief of Naval Intelligence to the group that was putting together this white paper that later was dubbed From the Sea. And in this graph, if you can imagine a vertical axis that is about threat, and a horizontal axis stretching from left to right that's about time, stretching into the future, he drew a huge curve, a big U-shaped curve on this slide. And what that line was describing was, as you went from left to right, the dissolution of the Soviet threat and the perception that the great power threat would bottom out at some point across the 1990s, and then sometime around 2005, 2010, that threat line would begin to creep back up, and inevitably we would face some balancing superpower threat, either Russia coming back, like Germany came back after the First World War, or the rise of something like China. And so I divided the arguments that I heard in this seminal debate between all these naval officers in which I participated, between where you looked on that curve for the potential focus of U.S. military activity. If you wanted to focus on the decline of the great power threat, which occurred across the 1990s, I dubbed that group the transitioneers, because their focus was on helping the world transition from the great power bipolar standoff of the Cold War to whatever was going to come next. And their notion was, if you managed that downward spiral of the great power threat from Russia and made a better world in the future, maybe that curve would never curve back up again. We'd never face a great power threat. That was mostly the surface community, for example, within the U.S. Navy and the Marines, who like to go into countries and deal with the little stuff, because that's been the Marines' role throughout history, the small wars and the small arms. The second group looked farther down that curve and really focused on the trough and said, you know what, it's not a focus on great powers anymore. Instead, we got to focus on the regional rogues. Okay, and our favorites then were two of our favorites now, Iran, North Korea, and then, of course, back then we had Iraq. And the notion was, you carry a big stick like Teddy Roosevelt. You speak softly, but when these regional rogues kind of pop their heads out of the hole, it's whack-a-mole time, and you smack them down as hard as possible. And if you're aggressive and focus on that, not get mixed up in trying to manage every crisis situation or failed state in the world, which was the transitioners' ambition, then you could keep that flat curve ad infinitum, and it would never rise back up again, because you'd manage the world well. Plus, you'd demonstrate your military power around the world in such a way that great powers would be scared off from challenging you in terms of rising up over time. The third argument said, you know what, you can't manage the world. The great power threat's going to go away. It'll bottom out. You can't become obsessed with regional rogues, because you're going to create a force that's focused on that kind of warfare. You really need to keep your powder dry, pick your fights very selectively, and wait for the inevitability of that great power threat curve to rise again. Whether it's China, whether it's a Japan that turns on us, whether it's Russia, it's got to happen, because you can't have a single superpower in the world without triggering a balancing response from the rest of the world's great powers.
Now, between these three competing camps, there were obviously agendas of what you would buy and what would matter a lot. And I think that's an overlay before we come back to it. The military is not a static situation. It's a budget that's got to be divided up. How intense is the competition both within the services and among the services?
It's very, very intense. And for example, using that breakdown in terms of the three camps, if you're a transitioneer, the argument was, hey, we got a lot on our plate now. We can induce from current operations, the here and now, what we need to keep. It's the stuff that we're using the most. And if we're using that stuff the most, we should get more of that stuff. And in terms of the high technology that may not be so applicable, let's just keep buying the stuff we know in smaller numbers, and we'll accept a certain strategic risk because we got a lot on our plates now. Okay? And you're hearing that argument today from the Army and the Marines, who are saying, hey, we're fighting a long war. I need a lot of small stuff. I need more people. That costs money. If you're telling me we can't buy a lot of fantastic weaponry for the future, well, by God, I'm losing 1,000 Marines an army a year here. That's more important. Let's get focused on what's right in front of us. The alternative argument is to say, and it corresponds to those whose weapon systems and platforms, aircraft and tanks and stuff like that, don't find the best applicability in the here and now, they'll say, well, the here and now is not that important. We really have to look into the future, imagine the worst possible enemy we can think of, and that's usually China right now, and from that future, deduce what we need to be buying now to make sure we have what we need in place 20, 25 years from now. And those arguments are under increasing attack right now because as the operational experience accumulates in the Iraqs and in the Afghanistans, and I believe we're going to find this kind of activity, we're going to get drawn into it in Africa over the next 20, 30 years to a great degree. Well, the arguments of the here and now types, the Army and the Marines, give us the stuff we need today, is beginning to bite into the arguments about I need this fantastic weapon for the future because that future looks more and more distant, and the here and now pain begins to add up.
Well, now let's turn to the China question because where you lose me, I've been reading Sea of Thunder, which is Evan Thomas's fine book about the naval campaign of 41 to 45. Mm-hmm. And Thomas Barnett, as you know, no one saw carriers coming to the extent that they came and became the dominant platform immediately. And so the war changed overnight, the way that naval forces were arrayed against. Is not the People's Republic of China now building the asymmetrical capacity to attack our carrier platforms from far off, cruise missile style, and thus take that power of the sea that you say is now firmly in our control away in the blink of an eye?
The focus of the Chinese military, I would argue, is not unlike the sort of myopic focus of the Indian military. The reason why the Indian Navy, for example, isn't as big as it should be given India's rise is that they're so obsessed with the land power issues of the Kashmir question with Pakistan. With China, they suffer a similar myopic focus. They build a military just so overwhelmingly focused on their desire to be able to threaten Taiwan and to prevent any movement of Taiwan towards independence. So, I mean, I spent a lot of time looking at the Soviet Navy across the Korea. I will argue the Soviets never had a true blue water Navy in the Cold War. And I will tell you on that basis, what I see with China is an effort to create a force, very specifically, that threatens our ability to threaten their ability to threaten Taiwan's ability to threaten independence. That force they're building is definitely designed to be an asymmetrical combatant with the United States if we come in on the side of Taiwan. It is not a force with legs. It does not have strategic reach. It cannot go anywhere seriously and wage war with any sort of duration. It has no real blue water capabilities and won't unless they build massively over a very long time. Now, even if they did that, okay, our worst estimates of their spending is about $70 billion a year. Last year we spent, including all operations, about $700 billion. If I look ahead to that 20 years from now scenario, I give us about an extra $10 trillion to deal with the Chinese threat.
I'll come right back.
If we hedge against that, I think we can.
We'll come right back and continue that conversation. It's the nub of this chapter and then transition to the lesser included. And a couple of your calls, 1-800-520-1234. As we continue on with Thomas P.M. Barnett, the Pentagon's new map on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back. It's Hugh Hewitt with Dr. Thomas Barnett, author of the Pentagon's new map, one of the country's preeminent grand strategists and analyst of military affairs. Dr. Barnett, when we went to break, we're talking about China and the American Navy. We have these 10 Nimitz-class carriers out there, which are really our force projection power. If China develops the ability to attack from land via cruise missiles, could that not vanish overnight, though?
Well, frankly, my gut reaction is that to that scenario is to say the age of the carriers is really gone because of cruise missiles and because of other capabilities. I think we've held on to the myth that carriers are the sine qua non of our ability to project power simply because nobody's building them. And it seems like such an obvious advantage, and we can, because we have control of the seas, park our airports right next door to something and fly at will. But with long-range the ability to refuel, and with the fact that we don't seem to have any trouble finding bases around the world. We worry about a lot, but when we lose one, we get another, and it's usually one closer to the fight we're interested in. The truth is, we don't need carriers in the way that the Navy will tell you that we do. And so the perceived threat of could the Chinese blow them up with cruise missiles, sure,
Well, that's consistent with what you wrote.
Would it make a difference now?
That's what I was getting at. So basically, we're oversized with carriers and we're oversized with submarines. Do we need, what do we need for a Navy, Dr. Burnett?
Well, I wouldn't get rid of carriers because they're so cool and because they're so versatile, and they last for almost ever. I would have fewer submarines. I would keep an eye on the Chinese submarine development, but I could go, it's hard to go much less than we have now. What we need to get, though, is to understand that we need to, and you see the current Chief of Naval Operations making this argument for a 1,000-ship Navy. We need to think the many and the cheap instead of the few and the absurdly expensive, and I would argue the absurdly vulnerable.
Okay, now that takes me to the lesser included. And I want you to expand on, because this is what the heart of the chapter is. After the Soviets went away, and if you break through the myth of the rising China threat, which we can come back to again in future weeks,
sure,
we're left with the lesser included. Who are they? What do they mean? What do you need to fight them?
Well, think of the world as kind of three tiers. There's the international system of states. There is the level of states themselves. And then there is the level of individuals living within states, living within a system of states. Okay, so a hierarchy of system, states, individuals. And if you think about the Cold War, the real threat was at the system level. We were going to fight World War III with nukes, and it was going to be the end of the planet. System-level war. Okay, that goes away with the Soviets. Nobody really talks about that anymore because it's not really a threat. So we downshift in the post-Cold War era, the 90s, to focus on the state level. Okay, and we get focused now on regional rogues. So Iraq, Iran, North Korea, anybody who's going to harm their neighbors, do that kind of stuff. Iraq invades Kuwait back at the beginning of the decade. We come in, kick Iraq out of Kuwait, make a real strong demonstration effect. Country A, if you want to attack Country B, by golly, the United States is coming, and we will kick you out, and we'll simply not allow you to do that, making a Leviathan-like declaration. And then it had a huge demonstration effect, because if you look across the 90s, state-on-state war disappears. Okay? We don't really have them anymore. Instead, what we have is a lot of violence and strife within countries. Now, as long as it's within countries and all you create is refugees for the next country over, and the United States has really nice neighbors, so to speak, we don't have to care about that. And we'll show up when it gets really bad and the genocide becomes, you know, unstomachable. But short of that, we don't have to go. Okay? That changes when the failed states that exhibit all this endemic strife and conflict become targets for takeover by transnational terrorists who begin to realize, I can be as super-empowered individuals, in the phrase of Tom Friedman from Lexis and the Olive Tree, I can wage war against states I consider evil across the system, taking advantage of the connectivity of globalization. So the attack on 9/11 is a brilliant example. They use the sine qua non of global connectivity, jetliners, and they attack great symbols of America's might. So the first time we all of a sudden have to realize, despite ruling out the danger of system-level war, and despite being able to scare anybody on the state level from waging classic state-on-state war, now we're down to the nut of the system.
Now, you write,
individuals and the dangers they represent.
You write in the book, I mostly entertained but did not inform my military audiences. Is that prior to 9/11, Thomas Burnett?
It was, because you know what I'd say to him? I'd come in and I'd say, violence is shifting downward in the system, and competition is shifting upward. Okay, economic competition is between states in the system now, and that's the real nature of our competition with China, which I think is very profound. I just don't think it's over Taiwan, and I don't think military weaponry and the classic scenarios are going to be how we fight or conflict or compete with China in the future. So violence goes down through those three tiers. Economic competition rises to the system level, and what we did across the 90s was we kept buying that big war force,
and needing a different one.
The everything else for.
We'll be right back with Thomas Burnett. Go nowhere. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt with Dr. Thomas P.M. Barnett, author of the Pentagon's new map. Dr. Barnett, I have to get some calls in, but I want to get to the rub of this. We sized our forces wrong. We thought wrongly about their use throughout the 90s. You don't blame the Clinton administration, except for perhaps not doing anything to stop the Pentagon's own mistreatment of themselves. But here we are. We're finally woken up to it. It looks to me like I'm about to embark upon a book-length case for expanding the Marine Corps. Am I wrong?
Absolutely.
Okay, tell me.
I mean, there's going to be a shift of resources from the air, which we dominate, to the ground, which we got to get better at.
And doesn't that mean an expanded Marine Corps and a much larger Special Forces arm of the Army?
It's a bigger Army, definitely. It's a bigger Marine Corps. There are specific arguments about how long it takes to raise a real SOF operator, Special Operations Force. But yes, more resources in that direction, and we're going to have to get smarter and more parsimonious in terms of the ships and the aircraft we buy.
Now, this may be in chapters 3 through 8, but is there any sense on your part that this Congress, the new Congress, and the left wing of the Democratic Party, is it all prepared to support any kind of military expansion or transformation of the sort that you note?
Well, there's always the reality of the demographic pressures in this country. We're going to age. That's going to mean more elder care costs. It's going to mean more medical costs. So I'm not somebody who's going to say raise the military at all costs. I think we can hedge against potential near-peer competitors like China with a certain amount of high-tech spending and big platform spending on aircraft and ships and whatnot. I think we could spend a lot more on our ground forces, and I think we need to do a lot more to ally ourselves with other big ground force countries in the world whose strategic interests increasingly overlap with our own. And there I will make, if given the time, a very strong case for strategic alliance with China.
We'll talk about that in the weeks ahead. But now let me ask you as well. We're so vastly more wealthy than any other superpower has ever been, even in relative terms, even to
right.
Rome. Why can't we afford more than 4% GDP and, as a hedge, build the Cold Warriors fighting machine at the same time as getting the Transformers small stuff out there in quantity? Why can't we have it all?
Well, I mean, we're spending roughly half the world's defense spending dollars. I mean, we spend about $700 billion, and the rest of the world spends about $700 billion. And I guess I'm one of those who would make the argument that with that kind of spending habit, half the world's money being spent on defense inside our own military, we ought to be able to make do with that.
Yeah, but they make us do everything, don't they? They make us. We're doing Iraq. We have to do Haiti. God knows if Rwanda breaks out again, we're going to have to do Rwanda. You know,
No argument in the sense that if we don't show up, nobody shows up.
Right.
But, you know, back to your question from last week, which sort of stunned me because nobody's ever asked this question in 5 years. What is grand strategy? Let me give you one simple rule for my grand strategy, and that would be in a long war, you need to maximize your definition of friends, and you need to minimize, meaning be very discreet and focused on your definition of enemies. And my main complaint with the Bush administration is they've added too many enemies and not enough friends.
All right, one more comment before we go to the phones. Page 105. My claim, your claim, Thomas Barnett, that 9/11 elevated military operations other than war to grand strategy is something I know many national security strategists will vehemently deny. How could they? Why would they?
Well, I mean, you've heard this argument out of the Robert Kaplan's and others who say, hey, the Middle East is a blip. The real fight's going to be with China in the future. I don't think the Middle East is a blip. I think it's going to be a long-term effort. I think it's going to be an integration effort on par with the Cold War effort to protect and integrate Europe. We're going to have forces there for the next 20, 30, 40 years. I think our competition with China is in making more markets around the world, and I think we're not looking at it along those lines, so that we're really putting at risk our strategic health, and we're not enlisting the help of countries with big militaries whose strategic interests overlap with our own. Why do we do this, though? I would argue it's a question of money. If you look at the $1.3 trillion in money planned on defense spending across defense platform spending, buying stuff, acquisitions over the next 20, 30 years, of that $1.3 trillion, I would argue about $1 trillion of it doesn't have a whole lot of applicability to a long war where you're going to be doing counterinsurgency and all sorts of nasty, dirty stuff in small wars and with small arms.
All right, to the phones.
There's an argument about protecting money here.
Thomas in Minneapolis, you're on with Dr. Barnett.
I'm wondering how Dr. Barnett's assertion of a diminished Soviet submarine threat squares with the report I heard that they're building a number of massive titanium-hulled submarines.
All right, Dr. Barnett.
Yeah, I think your caller's referring to the Chinese.
And are they?
Unless you're referring to an actual Russian submarine threat today.
Yeah, that's what he did. Is he wrong?
I don't know anybody who makes arguments about a resurgent Russian naval threat or a resurgent Russian military threat. I mean, their defense spending is right through the floor. I don't buy that one.
All right. Roger in Dallas. Welcome to the program. Roger, on with Dr. Barnett.
Hi, Dr. Barnett. I caught part of your briefing on C-SPAN a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The Marine Corps, when we were talking about framing the next war, came closer to anybody having it right back in 1990 with the fourth generation war definition. But to oversimplify what you're presenting tonight, it's down to Mao's strategic defensive and strategic offensive. If we prepare our forces along those lines, I think we'll be more equipped and better suited to deal with what's coming down the road. And we can't take our eye off the small nations and rogue players. And I'll leave it at that.
Dr. Barnett, you have 45 seconds to the break.
I agree with the caller in the sense that I think fourth-generation warfare is here. It's a resurrection of the ideas first in its modern form put forward by Mao and Revolutionary War. And the key thing to note with Mao's Revolutionary War is he said successful Revolutionary War is 80% political, 20% military. The new counterinsurgency manual out of Leavenworth, dual designated by the Marines in Quantico, says successful counterinsurgency is 20% military, 80% everything else.
And that's David Petraeus's manual, is it not?
Absolutely.
We'll be right back. Final segment for this week with Dr. Barnett. A couple more calls on The Hugh Hewitt Show. 55 minutes after the hour, it's Hugh Hewitt with Dr. Barnett. Dr. Barnett, are you enjoying these conversations?
I'm getting more psyched with each week.
I know. It's really, we're starting to get used to each other. Old Bill is one of our regular callers. He's a very smart guy. And Bill, just keep the question short, please.
Two brief questions. Dr. Barnett, what would you say to the statement that Norman Angel, in his Great Illusion, was basing his idea on the idea that great powers, governments of modern great powers, only go to war for rational purposes of economic aggrandizement? And the history of the 20th century, if it proves anything, ought to prove to us the falsity of that premise. Hitler and the Nazis had other motives than simply increasing the wealth of the German people or state.
All right, let's get a response from Dr. Barnett. Go ahead, Dr.
Yeah,
Barnett.
I think his statement was ahead of its time. It was wrong so long as you could actually wage war and get away with it on a great power basis. And the Germans certainly thought they could do that. What happens, though, with 1945 is nuclear weapons enter the scene. And nuclear weapons basically cap off the possibilities of great power war, so that the only countries willing to wage that kind of war are countries, frankly, that are small.
Bill, quick follow-up.
Second, okay, follow-up. I would challenge that the nuclear power caps off great power warfare. It merely makes cross-border invasions by uniformed armies out of bounds for great power warfare. But as we see with Islamofascism, nation states, including great powers, can find other ways to conquer their neighbors.
Well put. Now, go back to Dr. Barnett.
I don't argue with that. I just don't think it proves your point. There is no classic state-on-state war between great powers anymore, and there hasn't been any since 1945. Yes, alternative means are sought, but you're basically arguing for my point.
Mark in Denver, quickly, please.
Is that Mark in Denver?
Yep, you.
Hey, sorry. I love your show, Hugh, and guests, and a great topic. I'm going to get the book. Real quick, I may have missed this, but how does space play into this? So far, we've had a lot of technology advances, pretty much exclusive use of space.
All right, you got 45 seconds, Dr. Barnett. Space and war.
Space and war is it's tricky in the sense that the only people who are going to be able to really wage war in space anytime soon are going to be great powers, and it doesn't actually benefit them much because the advantages of space disappear when everybody starts getting up there and pointing nuclear weapons or other things at each other. So it falls into the same category as mutual assured destruction with nuclear weapons. It's hard to get decisive advantages up there without triggering the kind of same catastrophic responses you'd get with any sort of direct attack on another great power.
Dr. Barnett, as always, thanks. The Pentagon's new map is the book. We'll be on Chapter 3 next week. You can catch up, you should catch up, and you are not too far behind. Thank you, Dr. Barnett. We'll be right back. America, go nowhere. More calls, more stories. Jimmy Carter appearing on Al Jazeera. We'll tell you about that when we return to The Hugh Hewitt Show.